Good evening. It's good to see everyone that's out this evening. We appreciate you coming out. Of course, we've been looking into the period of time that occurs between the close of the Old Testament and the opening of the New Testament. We've been looking through the various empires that ruled and the effect that they had upon the Jews as they returned to their homeland there in Judea. We've looked at the empires of the Medes and the Persians and the Babylonians, the Medes and the Persians allowing the Jews to return to Judea and rebuild the capital. We've noted Alexander the Great as he came out of the west and conquered the empire of the Medes and the Persians and going even further away, all the way to the Indus River. And we noted that at his death, that his empire was broken up into four separate empires, and after a series of battles around 301 BC with the Peace of Ipsus, it was broken down into just simply three men, Ptolemy Soter in Egypt, Seleucus Nicator taking Thrace, Asia Minor, Syria, Babylon, Media, and all the way there into to India. And then we also noted that you had Antiochus Gonatus there. I don't know why this isn't showing up on mine. Was ruling in this area. Now, we looked at the Ptolemies last week. We noted that the Ptolemies were a great, wonderful soap opera with brother marrying sister and sister marrying brother, son, marrying their mother. Every kind of a way that you could put them together, they did it. And then instantly they would kill each other. We noted those things with the Ptolemies. Now, as we look at the Seleucids, the empire there that took up the what was called the Syrian Empire, that took up the old Babylonian Empire, the Mede and the Persian Empire, is pretty much the same thing. In fact, you'll find that they intermarried with the Ptolemies. In fact, the Cleopatras that we noted last week were a daughter of a Seleucid king and was given as a way to keep the peace between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. So we'll look at that some more this evening. I apologize, this time is getting close to the meeting and my time is getting shorter and shorter. This is what you're going to have for the overheads tonight, being able to look at the map. If you want these names typed out for you, I'll be sure and do that, but right now they're all handwritten. It's just time is with the studies for the meeting and everything and all the information for that. And as far as the meeting goes, we want to make sure that people understand we're going to be talking about evolution versus creation that Monday night of the meeting, looking at why it takes more faith to believe in evolution than it does to believe in creation, looking at some of the problems of evolution the time that is necessary for evolution that they don't really want to talk about very much. And I'm not a scholar on these things, but it's just looking purely at some of the things, and it doesn't take a scholar to understand that they're fraught with problems and assumptions, and that it takes a lot of faith to believe in those things. But you don't get taught that in school. Even though it's called a theory, you get taught that it's a fact. And then we're going to also look at what God expects of us and how we can be pleasing in the sight of God. It's just kind of, we're going to build throughout the week. And so if you begin talking to your friends and neighbors about that, begin encouraging them. More information is in the bulletin, and we're going to have some more on the website. And Lord willing, if things work out like we hope they will, we'll have some flyers for y'all to pass out Wednesday evening. So be keeping that in mind, and there's just a lot of effort that's going into the meeting behind the scenes. And just keep those individuals in your prayers as they're trying to get everything ready for that. All right, as we're looking at the Seleucids, of course, Seleucus Nicator was the first ruler of the Seleucids. He was the one that took over there after the fall of Alexander the Great, after the death of all of Alexander's family. And Seleucus Nicator, if you note, if you paid attention when we were talking about the peace treaty there at Ipsus, we noted that he was supposed to receive the area here of Judea. He was to receive Soela Syria, which include Damascus and Jerusalem all the way down into Judea. But one of the things we want to note about Seleucid Nicator was that he was a general underneath Ptolemy in the beginning. In fact, he was with Ptolemy's naval armies. And so when Ptolemy said, "I want Judea," having been someone underneath Ptolemy, you can have Judea. And as we noted in our lesson last week, the Ptolemies ruled over the Judeans for a good period of time. Now, Ptolemy treated them rather harshly. The first Ptolemy treated them rather harshly when he took over Jerusalem. and destroyed the walls. But after that, it seems that the Ptolemies kind of forgot about the Jews and just left them there and didn't really bother them too much. And we're going to see as we look at the lesson tonight that Judea is going to be wishing that they were still under the rule of the Ptolemies by the time the Seleucids start taking an interest in that area. Now, Seleucus Nicator died around 281 B.C., and his son Antiochus I, also known as Antiochus Soter, which means Savior, took over in 281 B.C. and ruled to around 261 B.C. He married his stepmother Stratonis, who was his father's wife, but not his mother. And his rule was plagued by various uprisings. A recurring theme we're going to see is that when one king dies, and remember, they're covering a huge area. You've got the Parthians and the Bactrians. You've got the Medes and the Persians that are in these areas that are way off. Their capital is here in Antioch. The primary capital is there in Antioch. And so you can see the far eastern portion of their empire is miles of thousands of miles away from the capital. And these the Parthians and the Bactrians are warlike people. And so one thing that we're going to see just about every time a king takes over after the death of his father or when brothers begin to fight over whether they get to be king or not, we see constant uprisings. And we see that at the very beginning with Antiochus I. His rule was plagued by uprisings. As he was beginning his rule, you had the Gauls that were coming down here in the area of what we know in the New Testament as Galatia. And so the Gauls were beginning to come in and cause problems. He defeated the Gauls in 278 B.C. and put to death his oldest son, Seleucus, who had been ruling in another portion of the empire to help him out. And he decided, well, he's rebelling against me, and so therefore he had him put to death. At the death of Antiochus I, Antiochus II, also known as Antiochus Theos, which means God, he began ruling in 261 B.C., and ruled to around 246 B.C. And when his father passed away and he took over, Antiochus II took over, that's when Parthia, who was over here in the far eastern side, decided that it wanted independence. And it proclaimed independence while Antiochus was fighting the second Syrian war. And we're going to have a series of wars there between Syria and Egypt. And so Antiochus II is over here in Antioch and he's dealing with problems with Egypt. And the Parthians decide we're no longer going to be a part of this empire, and they declare that they are independent. Around 255 B.C., Bactria, who is right there next to Parthia, decides, well, we're going to declare our independence as well. And so you can see the beginning of problems. And to end the hostilities, Antiochus with Egypt, Antiochus sends his wife Laodice into exile in Ephesus, and agrees to marry the daughter of Ptolemy II, a woman by the name of Bernice. You'll remember there were a lot of Cleopatras and Bernices there in the time of the Ptolemies. And so he marries the daughter of the leader of the Egyptians, Ptolemy II, after having sent his wife over to Ephesus. Now, after he hears that Ptolemy II has died, he begins to think, I guess, finally of Laodice, and he goes over into Asia Minor and begins to try to renew his romance there with Laodice. But we really see the fulfillment of the phrase coined by William Congreve, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And also, as we read in the book of Proverbs, there in Proverbs 21, verse 19, where the wise man says, it's better to live in a corner of a roof than in a house with a contentious woman. And that's exactly the way it was for him when he got there. Laodice did not exactly like the fact that she had been put away and another woman had taken her place. And so she poisoned him. And then quickly had others in Antioch kill the other wife, Bernice, and the infant son. And Laodice pronounced her son, Seleucus II Callinicus, king. He began ruling around 246 B.C. And because of his mother's actions, Seleucus II had to instantly begin dealing with a war against Egypt. Because remember, Antiochus had married a daughter of the Ptolemies, and then his ex-wife had her put to death. And so the Ptolemies are the Ptolemy that was in reigning at that time, Ptolemy the Third, who was the brother of Bernice, decided that's not a very nice thing to do. And so we have another war there between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The Ptolemy the Third, like I said, who was Bernice's brother, marched deep into the interior of the Assyrian Empire, even going beyond the Tigris River here, going past the capital and going deep into the empire. And at the same time, the Egyptian navy is attacking this area up here. And so really, the Seleucids are catching it from both sides, from the Ptolemies. Seleucus II was able to regain some of the territory that Ptolemy, after Ptolemy the Third returned to Egypt. And it appears that Leodice advised Seleucus to appoint his brother Antiochus Hyrax over the territories there in Asia Minor. And so Seleucus II is dealing with problems over here, trying to reclaim territory that had been lost. And he leaves the territories over there in Asia Minor to his brother. Antiochus, his brother, immediately declared independence of the territories there in Asia Minor. And civil war erupted between the two brothers, further weakening the Assyrian Empire. After reaching a stalemate, Seleucus II finally agreed to leave Asia Minor to his brother and turned east to try to once again reconquer the Parthians to the empire, where he ultimately failed and was taken prisoner. Antiochus began feeling the heat as the Attalids rose in power here from the area of Pergamum. Problems began to arise from over here, and so he's catching flak from that. And he eventually dies as a fugitive in the area of Thrace around 228 to 227 B.C. Not long afterwards, Seleucus, his brother, Seleucus II, dies from a fall from his horse. This brings Seleucus III, Saranus, to come to power in 225 B.C., and he ruled to around 223 B.C. If you didn't take very much math to figure out, they didn't like him. And in fact, he was killed by his own men during a campaign against Attalus I of Pergamum. This brought in Antiochus III, also known as Antiochus the Great, around 223 B.C. These two were sons of Leodice, not to be confused with the first Leodice mother. This was another one, and we're going to find there's several Leodices, just like there's several Cleopatras and Bernices. Antiochus III, over time, became the most successful of all of the Seleucid kings since the very first Seleucus Nicator. He inherited just a fraction of what the empire had been. Once again, Asia Minor, Bactria, Asia Minor over here has broken away and is no longer a part of the empire. Bactria and Parthia have been taken away from the empire. They've declared their independence and haven't been returned. And the Medes and the Persians are revolting as soon as he takes over. And so Antiochus begins his reign by attempting to recapture Judea, which once again, as you remember, has been ruled by the Ptolemies for over 100 years now. For around 100 years, and he tries to take that over and return that. While he's doing that, he also sends armies out into the eastern portion to try and bring the Medes and the Persians back in line. And he also tries to advance in Asia Minor. And out of those three different fronts, trying to take Judea, he's rebuffed. Trying to take the Medes and the Persians, they send him packing. Only in Asia Minor does he have really any success. In 221 B.C., Antiochus went himself out east. He had sent a general before. He decided, well, I need to do this myself. Kind of the old phrase, if you want a job done, you got to do it yourself. And so he decided he'd go out and went against the rebellious territories and brought them under control. Around 219 to 218 B.C., Antiochus again turned south towards Judea and the Ptolemies, where once again he's defeated. And he once again turns east against Bactria and even goes so far as to cross the Indus River into India to renew a friendship with the king there, and where he also received a gift of 150 war elephants, which in that day and time was like getting about 150 tanks to add into the things that you had to go in. And so he turned back west. When Ptolemy V Epiphanes came to power, there in Egypt, remember we talked about this last week, Antiochus III and Philip V of Macedon. Here he's ruling up in this area of Macedon. You've got Philip V and Antiochus III. They decide while there's some problems there in Egypt with the Ptolemies that they would divide up the areas. They joined forces to divide these areas. And by 198 B.C., Antiochus had control of Judea, ending the Ptolemaic rule, and they never again really were able to hold Judea again. The Ptolemies weren't. Antiochus, fresh on the heels of his victory, decided it was time to head northwest into Asia Minor again. And after going back into Asia Minor, he receives word that the Romans had left Greece. And he has along with him a fellow by the name of Hannibal, who was a very well-known Carthaginian general who fought in the various wars between Carthage and Rome. He's hanging out there in the court of the Seleucids and is an advisor there to Antiochus. And he encourages him to go on into Greece. And so Antiochus goes into Greece, invades Greece with about 10,000 men around 192 B.C. And in the beginning, he seems to be rather victorious. Some of the Greek cities decide, hey, we'd rather have the Seleucids ruling over us than having to pay tribute to Rome. But in 191 B.C., he suffered a horrific defeat by the Romans at Thermopylae and withdrew to Asia. And after further defeats at Magnesia around 190 B.C., he eventually was forced to sign the Treaty of Apamea in 188 B.C. Now, in this treaty, it meant that he had to give up all European territory. Anything that he had conquered there in Greece, he had to give that up. He was also forced to give up the majority of Asia Minor, anything above the Taurus Mountains, which run anything above that, which ran around right here. He had to give that up as well. And then he also had to pay a huge indemnity. In fact, when you look at most historical accounts, they say it was the largest indemnity any empire had been required to pay. In fact, it was so great, he didn't have the money. And all of his empire, he didn't have the money. And it's just a few years later, in 187 B.C., 1 year later, in 187 B.C., that Antiochus II is killed as he's trying to rob the temple at Elymais there in Persia to try to raise money. He's going and robbing these temples, trying to take their temple taxes, their gold, to try and send money to Rome. Now, as he dies, his son Seleucus IV Philopater, who was also a son of Laodice, but this is a different Laodice than the others. Once again, he's the brother of Cleopatra I of Egypt, who had been given to the Ptolemies as a kind of a peace. Let's not fight between the Syrians and the Egyptians anymore. And he inherited a kingdom that was racked with debt. And in an attempt to raise money, he sent Heliodorus to Jerusalem to seize the temple treasury there. He just follows in his father's footsteps and decides if there's a temple that has some money, let's go get it out of him. Heliodorus returns successfully, having robbed the temple there in Jerusalem, and decides, why do I want to be under this guy? I could take over for myself. So he assassinates Seleucus and assumes the throne. Demetrius, who was Seleucus' oldest son, had been taken hostage by Rome to make sure that they paid their debt. In other words, it was holding him for ransom. And so he's in Rome, and so Antiochus IV, also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, which means God manifest, who was Seleucus' younger brother, came to power in a move to remove Heliodorus. He was a young son of Seleucus, and also had been an official head of state. There was another son, infant son of Seleucus that Antiochus agreed to let be the official king while he ruled in the background until he decided to he didn't want to rule with anybody else, and so he had the young infant son put to death. In 175 B.C., Antiochus IV took over full power, and really he is the worst of all the rulers of the Seleucids as far as how he treated the Jews. As we look at these things, remember it was his father, Antiochus' father, who had originally been defeated by the Romans and had to pay this indemnity. And in the beginning, Antiochus IV was the one that had been taken captive and held as ransom. But when his brother Seleucus took over after the death of their father, they swapped him out for Demetrius, who would have been the next in line. And so Antiochus IV had been in Rome, and after he gets back around 170 B.C., Ptolemy VI demands that he return Soela Syria, which includes Judea. And this made Antiochus IV rather irritated. And so he invaded Egypt, conquering everything but Alexandria. And so he comes down. They want to take Judea back, and he says, you're not going to get it. So he goes down into Egypt, and he takes everything except the city of Alexandria. He even captures Ptolemy VI, but allows him to continue to rule to keep from offending Rome. Once again, we see where Rome is coming up more and more in the history that we're looking at. Once Antiochus withdrew, Ptolemy the VIII was chosen to rule by the loyalists there in Alexandria. And as we noted last week, he ruled jointly with his brother Ptolemy the VI, along with their sister Cleopatra the II. In 168 BC, Antiochus the IV got tired of the uppityness of the Ptolemies and once again invaded Egypt and was seemingly victorious until he was met by one individual. There was an older gentleman by the name of Gaius Popilius Laenas who met him. He was an ambassador of Rome. And we have an account of these things from the chapters from the foundation of the city by Livy that was recorded in the last century BC, the first century BC. And it says, after receiving the submission of the inhabitants of Memphis and of the rest of the Egyptian people, some submitting voluntarily, others under threats, Antiochus marched by easy stages toward Alexandria. After crossing the river at Eleusis, about 4 miles from Alexandria, he was met by the Roman commissioners to whom he gave a friendly greeting and held out his hand to Popilius. Popilius, however, placed in his hand the tablets on which was written the decree of the Senate and told him first of all to read that. After reading it through, he said he would call his friends into council and consider what he ought to do. Popilius, stern and imperious as ever, drew a circle round the king with the stick he was carrying and said, "Before you step out of that circle, you must give me a reply to lay before the Senate." For a few minutes he hesitated, Antiochus hesitated, astounded at such a peremptory order, and at last replied, "I will do what the Senate thinks right." And it was not until then that Popilius extended his hand to the king as to a friend, an ally. In other words, he drew the line in the sand and said, "You can't cross that until you give us an answer." Once again, we can see the power of Rome in that Antiochus the IV, one of the most powerful of the kings of the Seleucids, is bowing to the power of the Roman Senate. After these things occurred, he didn't exactly like his life. Some called him Antiochus the Madman. After he left Egypt, he was still reeling that he had been sent packing by one Roman individual. And while he was in Egypt, rumors had spread that he had passed away, that he had been killed. And so Jason, who was a high priest that had been removed from his position, led a force of 1,000 Jews in revolt against Menelaus, who was the one that Antiochus the IV had placed in the position of high priest. Now, if you pay attention to those two names, neither of those are Hebrew names. In other words, you have Greek Jews, Jews that had taken on the Greek lifestyle, that were high priest in the city of Jerusalem. And in fact, essentially, they were rulers over Jerusalem under the power of the Syrians. Now, Jason comes in and sends Menelaus packing. He's forced to flee the city. Around 167, Antiochus is coming back up from Egypt. He's been horribly embarrassed by being sent packing by the Roman Senate. And he attacks Jerusalem and attacks them in such a horrible, horrible way in his attempt to restore Menelaus, who he had appointed. We have a couple of accounts of this in the second book of the Maccabees. In 2 Maccabees chapter 5, there beginning in verse 11, it says, "When these things were reported to the king, he thought that Judea was in revolt. Raging like a wild animal, he set out from Egypt and took Jerusalem by storm. He ordered his soldiers to cut down without mercy those whom they met and to slay those who took refuge in their houses. There was a massacre of young and old, a killing of women and children, a slaughter of virgins and infants. In the space of 3 days, 80,000 were lost. 40,000 meeting a violent death, and the same number being sold into slavery." You go further in 2 Maccabees in the 6th chapter, beginning there in verse 1. It says, "Not long after this, the king sent an Athenian senator to force the Jews to abandon the customs of their ancestors and live no longer by the laws of God." In other words, he outlawed Judaism. Further, he went about profaning the temple in Jerusalem and dedicated it to the Olympian Zeus. The way he went about profaning it was he offered pigs on the altar. Now, if you know your Jewish religion, you know that swine, pigs, are unclean. And so he did what he thought would be the worst thing in the world. He offered that on their altar. He placed a figure of Zeus there inside the temple and declared that on Mount Gerizim to Zeus the hospitable as the inhabitants of the place requested. They also brought into the temple things that were forbidden, so that the altar was covered with abominable offerings prohibited by the laws. A man could not keep the Sabbath or celebrate the traditional feast, nor even admit that he was a Jew. At the suggestion of the citizens of Ptolemais, a decree was issued ordering the neighboring Greek cities to act in the same way against the Jews and oblige them to partake of the sacrifices and put to death those who would not consent to adopt the customs of the Greeks. It was obvious, therefore, that disaster impended. Thus, two women who were arrested, this is truly horrific, two women who were arrested for having circumcised their children were publicly paraded about the city with their babies hanging at their breast and then thrown down from the top of the city wall. Others who had assembled in nearby caves to observe the Sabbath in secret were betrayed to Philip and all burned to death. Once again, you can see the Jews were looking back fondly to the Ptolemies who had been ruling over them, who after the Ptolemy the First pretty much just left them alone. They had continued to worship God. And Antiochus the Fourth, in his madness, just goes about and does his best to remove the Jewish people. Now, it is because of this that we have the beginning of what we all know of as the Maccabean Revolt, which is immortalized in the Jewish time called Hanukkah. That comes from this period of time. And we'll look at that, Lord willing, in a couple of weeks. I'm going to hold off on the rest of these until after the meeting when I have a little bit more time to deal with them. But we'll look at the Maccabees and look at some of these things in a little bit more depth. But this was really the beginning of the end. Not only for Antiochus, who died in 164 B.C., just a few years after sacking Jerusalem and causing all the problems there. He went further in trying to reclaim the Parthians while his commander Lysias tried unsuccessfully to put down the Maccabean revolt. And what we also see that it was the beginning of the end for the Seleucid Empire. One of the things that we want to note is that Antiochus the Fourth had left an infant son, Antiochus the Fifth Eupator, who was just a child at the time, as the only heir, and there were a number of rival claims that came up to throw the empire into civil war. But Antiochus the Fourth is possibly best known as the villain of the Maccabean revolt and the time of the Hanukkah. In fact, rabbis refer to him, the old rabbinical writings refer to him as the wicked. And it's also believed by many that he is, remember when we studied in Daniel chapter 8 and we looked at the prophecies that were there of the ram with two horns, and the he-goat with one horn came and destroyed the ram with the two horns. And then once the single horn had magnified himself, it broke and far grew into its place. And remember there towards the end of Daniel chapter 8, after those horns were broken, a smaller horn grew up in its place. And we can read there, if you turn over to Daniel chapter 8, we can read there in the latter portion of that chapter, when you read these things and think about the things that Antiochus the Fourth did, you can see he fits in quite well with these things. If you look there in Daniel chapter 8, let's begin reading there in verse 9, this little horn that comes up after these four horns. In verse 9 of Daniel chapter 8, it says, "Out of one of them came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land," that is, Palestine. "It grew up to the host of heaven, and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host, and it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn, along with the regular sacrifice, and it will fling true to the ground, and perform its will, and prosper." Now that pretty much fits Antiochus the Fourth, does it not? He went to if you look at what it says, he went to the south, he conquered portions of Egypt. In fact, he conquered Egypt, all except for Alexandria, twice. He went toward the east. He went out and tried to bring the Parthians and the Bactrians and the Medes and the Persians back into line. And then he took over Palestine. Antiochus lifted himself against heaven, raised himself up. Remember, his name was Antiochus Epiphanes, which means God manifest. In other words, he lifted himself up on the plane with God. Making himself equal. The idea that it shows there of some of the stars falling to earth and being trampled down, oftentimes you'll find in apocalyptic literature the sun, the moon, the stars are darkened or thrown down, and it signifies the removal of power. And he removed really the power of the Ptolemies and the power of many others. And so we can see that Antiochus the Fourth really fits well in this, in that he takes over the place of the sanctuary and offers all these things, turning against God. As all these things were happening. Another reason why the Jews in the first century hated the Samaritans so much, up until this point in time, remember we talked about when the Jews came to rebuild the temple and everything, the Samaritans were like, hey, we're your brothers, we're the same cloth, and we're all descendants of Abraham, let us help you with this. And they said, no, we don't want your help. And the Samaritans had built their own temple and they were offering a half-breed worship to God. Well, once they saw what was happening to the Jews there in Jerusalem and in the areas around Jerusalem, they said, hey, we're not Jews at all. We don't have anything to do with these people. We're a complete and total separate people. We're willing to offer our worship to Zeus. That we don't have a problem with that. And so that was another reason why the Jews of Palestine had such a hatred for the Samaritans. After the death of Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus the Fifth, also known as Antiochus Eupator, took over around 164, and he reigned till around 162 BC. He was just a young boy at the time, around 9 years of age. Lysias, who was the commander that had been used by Antiochus the Fourth to put down the Maccabean revolt, was regent in his place. Rome still had Demetrius, who was the son of Seleucus the Fourth and the rightful heir to the throne. Rome went about sinking Syrian warships and crippled. They pretty much walked through the Syrian Empire and committed whatever atrocities they desired. In fact, they hamstrung all of the elephants. Remember the 150 war elephants that he had? They went through and crippled all of them to where they were reduced to really nothing. Demetrius finally escaped, and Antiochus Eupator was put to death at the young age of 11 by his uncle. Demetrius the First, also known as Demetrius Soter, which is also Demetrius the Savior, began reigning around 162 BC. And once again, when he took over, all these problems were taking place. The outer provinces of the Parthians and the Medes and the Bactrians, they all began to exert their independence once again, saying they were no longer a part of the Syrian Empire. Demetrius the First even went so far as defeating all of those and bringing them back into the under his control, and even defeated the Maccabees and temporarily reunited the empire. However, Alexander Ballas, who was lifted up as a supposed natural son of Antiochus the Fourth, that is Antiochus Epiphanes, was champion as the rightful heir, and they went to Rome, and Rome said, hey, we like this guy better than we like you. And so Rome, through its power, decided to side with Alexander Ballas, and Demetrius was defeated and killed in 150 BC. Alexander Ballas, who was supposed to be a son of Antiochus IV, begins reigning in 150 BC. He was recognized by the Roman Senate and by Ptolemy Philometor, the ruler over the Egyptians. And he married Cleopatra Thea, who was the daughter of Cleopatra II. Alexander was truly a terrible king. He was like, if you remember, the last king of the Babylonian Empire, Belshazzar. He was a party person. He lived a life of debauchery. And Alexander's own father-in-law, Ptolemy Philometor, decided to swap sides to Demetrius II, who was the son of Demetrius I, as he attempted to regain the throne. Alexander was defeated at the Battle of Antioch and fled to Arabia, where he was eventually killed by a prince there, and his head was sent on a platter to Ptolemy to let him know that he had been put to death. Demetrius II ruled from 147 to 139 BC. He married the wife of his stepbrother. He married Cleopatra Thea, who had divorced Alexander before his death. And troubles quickly arose. No one liked the fact that he'd become king through the help of the Ptolemies. And a general by the name of Diodotus conquered Antioch and made Antiochus the Sixth Dionysius king and divided the empire. He was an infant son of Alexander Belus. In 139 BC, Demetrius sought to put down an uprising from the Parthians in the east and was eventually taken captive by Mithridates the First, the king of the Parthians. This gave full power to Antiochus the Seventh, Demetrius' younger brother, who also married his sister/sister-in-law. Demetrius II was kept alive and given a Parthian princess as a wife. In 130 BC, Antiochus VII marched against Parthia. In an effort to cite civil war, the Parthians decided, well, we've got a brother over here, let's let him loose, and they'll fight for each other for the power, and therefore we won't have to deal with them, they'll be so busy dealing with each other. And it seemed like a great plan until Antiochus the Sidetes was put to death. He was defeated soon after Demetrius was released and never met Demetrius. And then the Parthians were like, well, we've got to get Demetrius back because he's the rightful heir. And they failed in that. So Demetrius was able to go back and to take over. And Ptolemy the Eighth, who was the brother of Cleopatra the Second, gave him armies, hoping. Cleopatra the Second gave Demetrius armies, hoping that he would help her against her brother Ptolemy the Eighth. Whereas Ptolemy the Eighth decided, well, we want Alexander the Second as a usurper. In 126 BC, Demetrius was defeated at Damascus and fled to Ptolemais. But his wife Cleopatra Thea, who had divorced him and married someone else, decided, well, I'm not going to open the city to you. He fled down to the Mediterranean Ocean, Mediterranean Sea, was captured in a ship near Tyre, and according to reports, he was tortured before he died. This left Cleopatra Thea, who had been married to a couple of brothers and uncles and things of that nature, she was left alone ruling from 125 to 121 BC. She had been queen since 150 BC. And she sent her son Antiochus the Ninth, also known as Antiochus Cyzicus, to Asia Minor. And Seleucus the Fifth became king after his father Demetrius' death, but Cleopatra Thea didn't want to give up the power, and so she had him put to death. She shared the throne with another son by the name of Antiochus the Eighth, also known as Grippus, which means hook nose. As Grippus grew older, she realized that she couldn't control him as she wanted to. And so one day after he returned home from a long hunt, she brought him out a glass of wine and said, here, son, have some wine. And this was very much against her character. And Grippus decides, well, how about you drink the wine? And he ended up forcing her to drink the wine. And, of course, she died around 121 B.C. Antiochus the Eighth, Grippus took over in 125 B.C. and ruled all the way to 96 B.C. He married Cleopatra the Sixth, Tryphema. He ruled rather well and brought stability to the remains of the empire over the next several years, but it still was not what it had been. Cleopatra Thea's other son, Antiochus the Ninth, returned to Syria to lay his claim to the throne around 114 BC. Antiochus the Ninth's wife, who was also named Cleopatra, was half-sister to Cleopatra Tryphena. She didn't like her half-sister and her husband taking some of the power, so she had her half-sister put to death. Antiochus the Ninth then killed Tryphema, his half-sister-in-law, in revenge, and ruled jointly with Antiochus the Eighth, Grippus, until Grippus' death in 96 B.C. Antiochus Grippus had five sons that fought for power not long afterwards. Antiochus the Ninth was killed quickly by Antiochus Grippus' son, Seleucus the Sixth. And really, you have Seleucus the Sixth, Epiphanes, Antiochus the eleventh Epiphanes, Philip the First, Philadelphus, Demetrius the Third, Eucharist, and Antiochus the Twelfth, Dionysius, that are fighting for power. After several deaths in around 95 BC, Seleucus the Sixth is killed by his brother Antiochus in 95 BC. Demetrius III kills Antiochus and takes over and rules for just a very brief period of time. He defeats the Maccabees once again and but he eventually is forced to withdraw. He rules jointly with his brother Antiochus the 11th and Philip the I. He attempts to dethrone his brothers, but was captured by the Parthians, where he remained until his death in 88 BC. This left just Philip the First, Philadelphus, and Antiochus the 11th, Epiphanes, who ruled from around 95. Philip ruled from 95 to 83 B.C., and Antiochus the 11th ruled from around 95 to 92 B.C. It's believed by historians that these two were twin brothers, and so they were ruling together. Antiochus drowns in the Orontes River, and Philip the First pretty much disappears from history around 83 B.C. when Tigranes of Armenia... I lost my clicker. Armenia is right up there in this northern portion above Syria. He pretty much disappears, and along with him, the Seleucid Empire disappears. The Armenians take over and rule until the Romans come to full power. So that brings us to the end of the Ptolemies. It brings us to the end of the Seleucids. Like I said, after the meeting, Lord willing, we'll look at the Maccabees, because that is the Jewish people there in that period of time. And just keep in mind, if you were a Jew living in this period of time, If you were a Jew living in this period of time and all these things are going on around you, you've got the Seleucids and the Ptolemies fighting back and forth, brothers and sisters fighting back and forth over your particular area. Imagine living during that period of time. And so we'll look at the Maccabees as we draw closer to the end. But just to see all these things that have been prophesied in Daniel chapter 8, prophesied during the Babylonian Empire, before the Medes and the Persians, before the Greeks, you look at how clearly it is to see the fulfillment of these prophecies in Daniel chapter 2 and also in Daniel chapter 8. And seeing how God set these things in order, He proclaimed how these things were going to take place. And it brings to mind once again that which we've been trying to remind ourselves in all of this, that God is ruling. Even if He's not speaking to us, remember there was a famine for the Word of God. God was still in power. God was lifting up and God was bringing low those that He thought needed to be brought low. And the same is today. We may think we've got the most godless individual over us. You go back just a couple of years and everybody was against President Bush, and nowadays they're against President Obama. These people are there for a purpose. And because they are a power, they deserve our respect no matter how much we disagree with them. God is ruling in the nations of men. And what we need to understand and what we're going to see with the Jews is we need to be like those Maccabees who are unwilling to take on the Greek way of life, who are unwilling to accept the sacrifices to the Grecian gods, that were willing to stand up and die and remain faithful to God. That's what we need to be like in our lives. No matter how the world may change, we must remain faithful to God in our service. If you're here this evening and you've never obeyed the gospel, then tonight is your opportunity to obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, to become a part of His kingdom. As we get further, we're going to look at that other kingdom that's just vaguely referenced there in Daniel chapter 2. That kingdom that's going to be set up during the days of the Roman Empire. That's the kingdom we get to be a part of today. And as was prophesied, that's the kingdom that will never be destroyed. If you're not a part of that kingdom, become a part today. If you've obeyed the gospel but not remained faithful, tonight is your opportunity to regain faithfulness to God by repenting of your sins. Whatever your situation, we ask that you come forward now as we stand and as we sing.